Once upon a time, there were four little rabbits.
How old are you, Johnny? She asked.
16.
We few, we happy few, we band of brothers.
It was the best of times. It was the worst of times.
A wise old king once said, "Of the making of books, there is no end." How true today. Of the overabundance of writing published each year, what's worth reading? The answer is simple. Read only the best. Come join the discussion on Just the Best Literature.
Hello again, everyone. Thanks for listening in today. Well, on our previous program, the 60-plus panel got together and we began talking about young Lawrence at Carchemish. So I want to jump right back into it today. So with me in the studio again today is my best friend in literature, my wife, Deborah. Welcome back, Deborah.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
It's good to have you here. Well, I do have a comment that I want everyone to listen to, and this is really, I think, a very exciting comment. This is from England. It says, "Hi, JBL. Just a few lines to say how much I've been enjoying your review of Hero. I'm currently on chapter 3. As a Brit in his 50s, like most of my generation, T.E. Lawrence is Peter O'Toole. Tall, dashing, neurotic perhaps, certainly not a 5.5-foot archaeologist. It is interesting to have my perceptions gradually replaced. I particularly like listening to you and your guest's viewpoints. To hear him described by Americans as a hero is gratifying, as he is part of the British psyche. All too often, British colonialism and intervention caused and continues to cause unrest in the world, but Lawrence represents a more philanthropic aspect, siding with indigenous peoples against politicians. His comment that he never felt properly at home when he later returned to the West is very telling and perhaps explains his later life. Thank you for introducing me to Korda's book, and I look forward to future episodes. P.S. I have a slight connection to the story in that my wife is a distant relative of Augustus John, who painted the magnificent portrait of Lawrence in his robes, now on display in the National Portrait Gallery in Trafalgar Square."
Oh, that's neat.
So that's a great comment. So thank you. His name is Peter from England. So thank you, Peter, for sending that. And it's always my desire to get back to my roots in England, since I'm mostly English, which drives my wife crazy, because I'm also Irish, and she is Irish. So we won't get into that today. So the last time we did not get to the point where Lawrence really knew how to get his own way. So let me just read to you what Korda says on page 185. This whole idea of him getting to Carchemish, it says him going there was really going to be kind of a challenge. Hogarth, I think that's the better way to say it. Hogarth wanted Lawrence to go on the dig. Now remember, he's just a young student at Oxford. And there was going to be some challenges. But here's what Korda says. "This raised any number of difficulties, since Lawrence was receiving a scholarship from Jesus College to support his research on medieval pottery for a British literature degree, which on the face of things seemed incompatible with excavating a Hittite site in Syria. But despite Leeds' doubt, Lawrence demonstrated his lifelong ability to get his own way." So yeah, you were dealing with the master, and when you were dealing with T.E. Lawrence and getting his own way. But I think what this what Korda shows is that Hogarth was equally talented in getting his own way as well. And I think I didn't read all of this page to you, but the point is Hogarth was from I think Magdalen College, so he was at a different college at Oxford. And, you know, I always think of, when I think of Oxford, I think of Shakespeare for some reason. Sorry about that. But anyway, Lawrence was from Jesus College. So to get him out of Jesus College for, I think this dig took about, 2 to 4 years. And so it was going to take a lot of work. And, but Hogarth knew how to get his own way. And so essentially what happened for this, and this is where I think we have to admit that Lawrence, even at a young age, could find really influential people to help him. Again, at the bottom of page 185, it says, Hogarth agreed to take Lawrence and then with superb diplomatic skill managed to secure for his young protege a senior demyship, a kind of research fellowship at his own college, Magdalen, which meant that the British Museum would not have to pay anything but Lawrence's living expenses at the site. This was not an inconsiderable feat. Lawrence's demyship would bring him £100 a year for 4 years. And Corda says that's about the equivalent of $12,500 a year today. So that's not bad wages for a student in 1910 or 1914 in that time frame. Now, how do you appease Jesus College? So again, Hogarth comes in here with great skill. He says, with equal skill, Jesus College was placated by the suggestion that Lawrence would not only continue his research on medieval pottery, but extend his survey of Crusader castles in Syria, enabling him to expand his Bachelor of Arts thesis into a book, and the British Museum was informed, a little optimistically, that his services were necessary to the expedition because of his command of Arabic, his familiarity with the area, and his knowledge about pottery. All this was the academic equivalent of a car room shot at billiards and speaks volumes about Hogarth's talent for manipulation and Lawrence's ability to claim convincingly many different skills at the same time. If Lawrence's parents had any doubts, Hogarth no doubt dealt with those as well. He seems to have gotten along well with both of them and moved swiftly to send Lawrence to Syria to improve his Arabic, which so much had been claimed. Excuse me. So look at this, and a lot of people maybe wouldn't think about it, but can you imagine, T. Lawrence, here he is, 19-year-old, coming and telling his parents, well, I'm going to Syria for 4 years.
I know, it's amazing. Amazing is his parents were for it. You know, they knew what he was like. But also, it's funny that they say claiming that how well he knew Arabic. He knew a few words, but he really didn't know Arabic that well.
He didn't know Arabic
well. No.
So yeah, maybe we could, again, I just want to point out that I think Hogarth and Lawrence were two peas of a pod. You know, they were alike, and they really found each other at just the perfect time. So let's talk about him perfecting his Arabic skills. So as soon as everything got settled, what did they do? What did Hogarth do? He sent him to school to learn Arabic, which
right,
I think
yes.
is funny.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll let you go ahead and take over some of that.
So he was in went to a mission school to perfect, that's quote unquote, his Arabic. His teacher, now this is going to be hard to pronounce. I'm going to try it, Farida El Akli or something like
yes,
that.
Yes, that sounds good enough to me.
And she was still alive in 1976. Was more realistic about her pupil's knowledge of the language than Hogarth had been. She praised his exceptional intelligence and his determination to master the language. I'm reading from page 187, by the way. But pointed out that in a short time, he could speak and write a little, it's funny, which is significantly less than the command of Arabic that Hogarth had attributed to him. It's curious that this supposedly crash course consisted only of 1 hour a day on a red sofa in the large hall, though Lawrence surely did a lot of reading and practice his Arabic on the streets of Jabail. I don't know how you pronounce that.
Jabail.
Yeah.
Anyway,
mm-hmm.
to me, that's the funny part.
Yes.
Can you imagine this 19-year-old, British guy, kind of like accosting everybody in the markets, trying to practice his Arabic? I think that would be hilarious. So
yeah.
Yes. You can see him doing it.
Oh, you can see it. It seems like he was we'll read about it later. It was kind of a personable young person that it was likable. And so you could see him, trying to talk to people and especially if he's trying to learn Arabic, maybe liking him. It seems like he was likable.
Yeah, I think he was definitely a provocative character, but I also think you wouldn't help but like him.
Right.
Yeah, because I think he had a great sense of humor. He was kind of very witty. I think he had a sharp tongue. I think he could really cut you to the quick if he needed to or wanted to. But I think she has some great things to say about him. You can go ahead and read some more if you like. I like it when you read.
thank you. Well, she does. I like this one part here on page 188 where Korda quotes her, and then he also adds some of his own thoughts. But it says that toward the end of her long life, this is the lady that was his teacher.
Yeah, she lived till 1976, so that's a long.
Quite a lot older. After being questioned by John Mack, a biographer of Lawrence, who was also professor of psychiatry at Harvard Medical School, Farida wrote to a friend, "Lawrence seems to me like an oyster, which has, through pain and suffering, all through life developed into a pearl, which the world is trying to evaluate, taking it to pieces layer by layer, without realizing the true value of the whole." And now Korda says, "There is some truth to this even today. Lawrence's detractors and admirers alike tend to dissect his personality into thin slices, separating the soldier from the scholar, the hero from the teller of tall tales, the victim of neuroses from the man of action." And we know that he did have some problems, all great men and a lot of people do.
Yeah.
But neuroses from the man of action, and in the process, losing sight of just what an attractive and interesting person he was, even at his most infuriating. So I think it's funny that he could be really infuriating. That's a hard word to say, infuriating, but at the same time, very attractive and interesting.
Well, she even said he had a sweet side.
Yeah, so he does. There was a sweet side. It says Farida clearly recognized this and understood early on that Lawrence was always more than the sum of his parts. Provocative as Lawrence could be, there was about him a certain sweetness of disposition, a spiritual quality, and above all else, that he was a special person destined for greatness, even though it was not yet clear what kind it would be.
Right. The reason I like the Korda book is that he does not want to psychoanalyze. And, a Harvard doctor or a student of psychiatry trying to dissect, it really, I don't know. I think there are some parts of, his personality and the problems he faced just are not worth mentioning. Let's look at the positive things. And I think Korda does a great thing, a great way of doing that in the book. I mean, there's a lot about Lawrence that parents could learn from, about how to raise children and to help children. And we'll talk about that some more. But I thought, here there's someone that's Arabic, I think has a better sense of how to look at Lawrence's life. And I think she saw that he was so sensitive to the Arabic people. I think she really appreciated that. And then we should look at everybody from the whole person and not just some difficulty they had and try and blow that up and expand it and, use it to your own advantage. And so I do think that that's probably one of the, I think the some of the best writing in this chapter is about that, seeing the whole person, not just, just dissect them layer by layer and get as thin as you can and focus on the worst thing that you can.
Right, yes. Sometimes there is a lot of writing that does that.
Yeah.
That focuses on the negative aspects of somebody
Yeah.
or something.
And the thing is he did, he really did gain, a lot from his parents. And again, his parents, they had real problems in their life. And, it's unfortunate for them. But, it's one of those things that... you don't have to focus on that. And I think Lawrence, he was a very moral person. He had a lot of character. And like you said, like we just hear Korda say there, he could be infuriating, but he could be sweet too. And he did do a lot, for the Arabic people. So, but anyway, let's go on now in this chapter. There's a few more things I want to get to, and we're probably going to have another program. So, because this is such a long chapter, but the thing that I think is so fascinating that Korda brings out is that even when he's in the Middle East now as an archaeologist, even as he's there as young now. So if he went when he was 19, in 4 years, so he was done there when he was 23. So he spent, like, to me, it's like he spent 4 years of expert training on how to get ready for World War I. And it's almost exactly like happened with Winston Churchill in the trenches, getting ready for World War II. And so Korda does a really, really great job of that, of bringing out that he's doing all these things with archaeology, but actually he's actually being prepared for his future task at Aqaba. And so it is really kind of interesting. One thing, I just think it's funny, and maybe it's not so funny, but the one paragraph, I guess it's really in the middle of the page, that on his when he finally gets everything ready to go, to get into the Middle East, he gets stopped for a long time because of all the snow in the Middle East.
Yes, we don't think about snow, do we, when we think of the Middle East?
We don't think about snow in the Middle East. We think about it just being hot and dry. And here at the middle of the page, it says, by February 18th, he was back in Beirut again to meet Hogarth. Those who think the Middle East as uninterruptedly hot should bear in mind that Lawrence reported the railway line between Beirut and Aleppo was blocked by 30 feet of snow for 7 kilometers. Now, I don't know how far 7 kilometers is, but it's not miles, but it's a long distance. It says, now notice what Korda says, a factor which would play a part in later stages of his campaign against the Turks in 1917 and 1918. So here he's on the railway, he's learning what's happening, and he experiences things he needs to experience or know about when he finally starts blowing up these trains.
Right.
it really is kind of amazing. So here he is stuck, and previously, he was stuck because he was on a French ship that had engine trouble, and I think it is funny that he didn't like being on the French ship because it at mealtimes took too long. we'll talk about some of that. I think it's funny when he finally gets to Jarablus, where it's close to the Hittite mound. He's put in charge of food, too. I think that's kind of funny. Yes. I don't know if I would want him in charge of my food.
He definitely would not call him gourmet or epicurus.
Epicurus,
no, because he really didn't care much about food. he wanted basics. That was not one of his interests.
Yeah, let me just read this some more about what he experienced there was preparing him for later. It says at the very bottom of the page, 189, it says, they were stuck there for some days since snow continued to fall in the mountains, while a ferocious storm prevented them from sailing. But they finally managed to get on a vessel bound for Haifa, and from there went on by train to Damascus on one of the railway lines that Lawrence would later spend much time and effort blowing up. They passed on their way Nazareth, which Lawrence wrote for his mother's benefit, was no uglier than Basingstoke. So, of course, his mother was very, very Christian, and of course, she would have been very interested if he had stopped at Nazareth to see Nazareth, since we know that's where Jesus Christ was born. But notice that he journeyed on to Dera, the vital railway junction where Lawrence would be taken prisoner, beaten, and suffer his worst and most painful humiliation. It says they lunched at the station buffet, which was fragrantly and evidently an exotic, and served food in an Eastern decor. Hogarth dazzled Lawrence by speaking with equal fluency Turkish and Greek, French and German, Italian and English, and even Lawrence remarked on how weird it was to be so far out of Europe. So he was getting prepared to be out of Europe for a long time. And so anyway, it says, this was no longer the rocky, hilly landscape of the Holy Land, which had once been fertile under Roman rule and over much of which he had walked on foot. Alongside the railway line lay the La Jolla, the lava no man's land, and the refuge of all the outlaws of the Ottoman Empire, almost impassable except to a native who knows the ways. One senses Lawrence's fascination with that vast, empty space. He had glimpsed from the train the fabled Great Hawes Road, the pilgrim way over which Doherty had approached on camel to the very outskirts of Mecca. That evening they reached Damascus, and from there via Homs went to Aleppo. And so you can see that he was really getting ready to, or maybe he was really getting prepared for what he was going to be doing, later in his life at Aqaba. So, you have anything you'd like to say there? Or have I taken the mic too much?
No, that's good. No.
Oh, I'm fine. Okay, good. All right. So let's see if we're going to be running out of time here again. But like I said, I think we're going to need definitely another program. But I think another thing that Korda brings out really, really well here is that it seems like at a very young age, like at 19, he found his element. He found what he needed to do in life. And so that's on the page of 191, kind of at the bottom of the page. It says, to say that Lawrence found himself in his element would be putting it mildly. He was far from home, fully occupied day and night. Indeed, he did not write home for another 10 days, being busy with establishing their living quarters. For the moment, Lawrence seemed to have been in charge of the food supply with two servants to prepare it, and was pleased to find excellent goat's milk and an ample supply of lentils. How pleased Hogarth and Thompson were is unrecorded.
I think that's funny.
I think it's hilarious.
Because he'd be happy with the goat's milk and lentils. I'm guessing he really was basically a vegetarian.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's kind of funny. But so, we don't know about Hogarth, and Thompson was the other man that they were working. He was working with.
Yeah, who probably really likes French. Really like French cuisine.
Right.
Yeah. But anyway, so in case you didn't catch up with us there, we are now at, I'm going to say that name correctly, Gerbilas. I always think of gerbil when I see that word. So that's probably not very nice. Okay. But anyway, he was in his element. Now, I think it's interesting. If you could just flip over to the next page, it says that Lawrence was also charged with putting up doors and shelves, the kind of hard work he delighted in, invariably producing something finer than what was expected or required. Indeed, his transformation of the living quarters soon became something of an obsession. Oddly enough, for a man who had spent many years of his life in the desert or in barracks, he had a passion and a real talent for domestic improvement and decoration. As for the digging, they began in the area where the British had stopped work 30 years ago and soon uncovered a great entrance staircase and a number of large bas-relief slabs. The work was difficult, involving the movement without machinery of huge rocks, slag, and shattered stone fragments of a later city, and went slowly. There's a statement there about the police. They're watching them. I'm not going to even try and pronounce that name. It says, at the end of the letter home, So again, what he does, he writes his mother. They do have soldiers protecting him. He says, at the end of his letter home, he adds briefly that they're expecting a visit from Miss G. Bell, the desert explorer, archaeologist, traveler, and author of Between the Desert and the Sound, the 42-year-old and already famous and glamorous figure. So she's a German archaeologist, and that's Miss Bell. And so he goes on to say then, in his letters home from Carchemish, Lawrence sounds like a man who has at last found his place in the world. Increasingly, he joined Gregarious in directing the men as they labored to move huge stones, some weighing many tons. He devised a derrick to help pull upright fallen statuary, repaired equipment, learned how to make his own paint, wrote home to have another pair of boots made and sent out to him, with slightly thicker soles and leather laces, since the rocky terrain was already wearing out his present boots. So you can just imagine him just busy all the time.
So he's one of these people who is really happy when he's busy and physically working hard. He likes to work. He liked to work really hard.
Yes.
And I think it is funny that it's kind of ironic that he had such a passion for woodwork or for handiwork with doors and shelves and in a house, you know, and setting up, basically like setting up housekeeping, and not really housekeeping, but setting up a home. And yet, he'd rather live outside, you know, in the desert, you know, and which is what he did most of the time.
Right. Yeah.
So it's kind of ironic.
And and it was harsh conditions.
Yes.
Bitten by bugs and fleas and.
Yeah, he didn't mind that. No, he didn't care about that.
He didn't care about it. So anyway, he's really an interesting young man, and to have those, all that show up just at when he's really in his early 20s now, he's slipping into his 20s. But it really is kind of fascinating. Well, like I said, we're going to have another program because there's a lot more in this chapter. So that's all we have time for today's program. Next time, we'll continue our discussion of Lawrence at Carchemish. Now remember, for this series of programs, we're using Michael Korda's book, Hero, The Life and Legend of Lawrence of Arabia. There is still plenty of time for you to get on board and start reading this book. You can buy this book at Amazon.com. You can find a used copy of the book at abebooks.com. And, of course, you can also check your local library. So, as these people have done the last couple programs, you can send me any comments to jbl@pcog.org. I'd like to hear what you think of this 19-year-old and his, his way of getting his own way. You can follow JBL on Twitter at JBLiterature1. You can also follow JBL on Facebook. Simply search for Just the Best Literature. So until next time, keep reading.
You've been listening to Just the Best Literature on Trumpet Radio, 101.3 KPCG, streaming online at kpcg.fm and thetrumpet.com.